The Guardian.
How do you test impulsivity in a fish?
Very good question.
Smaller objects in the Kuiper Belt have densities of 0.6 times water. They would actually float if you put them in water.
Oh, wow.
I have lots of periodic table ties.
I bet you do.
Because I'm a chemist and I usually wear one.
But I think in the future you'll see most of the tissues of the body will become printable in our lifetime.
I'll ask you another question which might sound a bit personal. Why are you holding a jar of urine?
I'm really pleased you asked.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Science Weekly with me, Alok Jha. I'm outside the Royal Society in London. We're here to see the annual summer science exhibit. This is a time when scientists from all over the UK get out of their labs and come into these hallowed halls to talk to us, the great unwashed public, about all their research. Everything from dark matter to DNA to 3D printing, it's all in this building. So I'm quite excited to see what's inside. Let's have a look. Hi, Professor Polyakov. I'm Alok. Nice to meet you. How are you doing?
Yeah.
I love your tie, first of all, can I just say?
Yes.
Can you just tell us, this is the chemistry tie?
Yes. This is the periodic table, and I have lots of periodic table ties.
I bet you do.
Because I'm a chemist, and I usually wear one.
Okay. Well, Martin, thank you very much for giving us your time. Can you tell us a bit about the history of this exhibit? Why do you guys let all these members of the unwashed public into your building?
Well, we let them here because we want to share the excitement of science. And what's special about our exhibition is that it's one where you can actually meet the scientists who are working on the research. You can go to the Science Museum and places like that and find out static exhibits about research. But here you can actually question the people doing the research, and also they haven't finished it. So you can find out what are the questions they still need to ask and so on. So it's a much more interactive exhibition. And it's been going on for many years. And if you look over here on the wall just beside me, there is a picture of the soiree, as it was called then, from about 100 years ago.
There's lots of Victorian-looking gentlemen.
Yes, no women, terrible. But this was before the Royal Society moved to these premises in 1967. And for the last 20 years or so, we've had an exhibition that's been open to the public. Originally, it was just for our fellows, which was okay. But now we want to try and communicate the excitement of what we're doing, we meaning scientists and engineers across the UK, to everybody. And obviously the number of people who can physically come here is relatively small, but we try and build on these exhibits with articles, YouTube videos and your podcast, so that we try and reach as many people as possible.
Now, there's a whole range of things here, DNA, cosmology, everything. Give us some of your highlights.
Well, it's always difficult to choose. I suppose one that excited me most so far was the exhibit on finding out what colour dinosaurs were. And they have a dinosaur with a long tail that looks like a marmalade cat with orange and white stripes. And the fact that you can tell the colour of a dinosaur, I think, is extraordinary. And if I'd been told that as a child, I would never have known it. And then again, there's one exhibit from some school children who are working on new antibacterial essential oils, and it's always very nice to see young people so enthusiastic about science early on in their career. This is a school from Boroughbridge in Yorkshire, and their school children coming round. You can see some round now. I think these are from Dame Alice Owen's school in Potter's Bar. And we've also got a rather worrying exhibit about the retreat of a glacier in Iceland, where over a few years the glacier has already retreated 200 meters. That's quite a...
So it's not all fun here, is it?
Well,
there's a serious message behind some of this stuff.
Of course. And the other thing which is quite interesting is there's one on the human genome, asking ethical questions. What do you actually want to know from your genome? Do you want to know whether you're going to die young or whatever? So I think it's posing quite serious questions and making people think.
Now, I've noticed one thing specifically wandering around these hallowed halls is that you get a lot of stickers at the stalls. And I've seen one on your suit, which is that you're less impulsive than a fish. Can you explain that one?
Well, not entirely, because I didn't have the full explanation. But they are doing experiments with zebrafish, you know, these little fish. And then they're testing people, looking at letters flicking up on a computer screen, which they can't be testing fish looking at letters. But apparently I'm more thoughtful than a fish.
which is probably a good thing, right?
Well, I had to ask whether being less impulsive than the fish was good or bad. I was told it was good, but okay. Perhaps they were being polite.
What do scientists get out of taking part in this? Because it's quite a lot of work. I mean, they're standing here continuously explaining stuff and interacting with people, and it's exhausting just watching them.
Most research groups take relays so that there are people coming from different parts of the research group and just doing shifts. I've done two exhibits. It's great fun, and I think it's very important for scientists to actually speak to the public and find out what they think about their research, find out what are the questions they want to ask. And my experience is that you get asked some quite profound questions and some completely mad questions.
At least they make you think, right?
Yes,
mad questions make you think.
Well, mad questions. I think when I was working on somebody asked me how I could treat his ingrown toenails, which was rather a long way from my chemical exhibit. But nevertheless, it was fun.
And you tried your best, I'm sure, to answer that question. I've got one final question for you, Martin. Where do I get a tie like yours?
If you Google periodic table ties, there's quite a good selection of them.
We do need to take a picture and post it somewhere because it's quite fabulous. Thank you very much, Martin.
Fine.
We'll let you get on with the exhibit.
Fine. Thank you.
So Martin said that he was less impulsive than a fish, so I can't actually wait to find out how impulsive I am. I'm going to go and find out now.
So I'm Dr. Caroline Brennan. I'm a lecturer in molecular genetics at Queen Mary University of London, and I'm a Royal Society Industry Research Fellow. Our research, what we're interested in, is finding genetic variations that influence your likelihood to suffer from psychiatric disease, to become an addict or have schizophrenia or something like that. And there are certain behaviours in humans that are associated with likelihood of becoming an addict, and one of those is impulse control, impulsivity. So your inability to control the impulse to do something. So what we do is we design tests of impulsive action in fish. Now, our fish have got large numbers of genetic variations in them. So we look for families of fish that have impulsive behaviour. We take those families of fish and we sequence them. So we find the genetic variations that they have. And then those genetic variations that affect the fish behaviour are likely to be genetic variations that in humans affect human behaviour.
How do you test impulsivity in a fish?
Aha, very good question. So what we do is we have a little test that's it's a variation of a rat rodent test. So what you do is you train the fish to approach a light for food reward. A light in one of five chambers. So the fish approaches the light that comes on randomly in one of five chambers. If he gets it right, he can go back down the other end of the tank and get food reward. And you can probe impulsive action by increasing the time delay between starting your test and turning on the light. And if the fish can't wait, it goes, I know it's going to happen, I know it's going to come, and it swims too soon, it's impulsive.
It's like it's run out of the gate a bit too quickly.
It goes out of the gate too soon, it shoots out too soon, and oh dear. Well, those are the ones that are impulsive. They have impulsive action, right? And so we take those fish, and then we sequence them, and we find the genes that are in them that aren't in the normal population.
So explain to me what the experiment you've got here is doing. What can you find out about me from that?
Well, this is a small version of the sorts of things that you would do if you were testing a human for impulsive action. So this is not a proper one. I'm not going to say if you do this and you come out more impulsive that all of a sudden you're destined to be an addict. Okay, so don't go away with that idea. It's a small version. So here what we ask you to do is to press a button every time you see a letter, unless it's the letter X. So you have this impulse to press this button all the time. And what you're asked to do is to control that impulse and stop doing it if it's letter X. And if you can't control the impulse to press the button, then you have poorer impulse control. right? Because you just press it anyway. So it's like going out of the gate too soon.
So there's no sense in just smashing the button continuously in that case.
Well, if you smash the button continually, you'll come out really impulsive, and that's it.
Can I have
it.
A go?
Of course you can.
Let's have a go. Press the green button to start. Okay. And I have to press the mouse whenever...
Or the green button, it doesn't matter.
Whenever there's a letter that's not X.
Whenever there's a letter that's not an X.
Okay, fine. I'm getting slightly nervous. I don't know why. It's not like there's no one watching this, is there? Okay, here we go. Here we go. Get ready. U. Oh, no. No, that's an X. A. E. P. K. P. J. Aha. I tricked those X's. These fish obviously are very good, aren't they?
The fish don't do this actual test. They do swimming to lights.
Oh,
they get
no.
food at the end. So you're less impulsive. So you're practically average, you see. You're there.
I'm practically average. Yeah. That's the result my mum wants to hear, isn't it? I'm basically... Thanks very much.
Average, yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Nice to meet you.
So I am actually less impulsive than a fish. That's scientifically proven, and I have a sticker to prove it. Now, there's so much going on here that what I've decided to do is just kind of wander the halls a bit. Go on a journey. Go from the smallest things, there's DNA here, all the way to the whole universe. Let's see what we find along the way.
My name's Steve Scott. I'm from the public engagement team at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute in Cambridge.
So Steve, we've come to one of the smallest... bits of the exhibition. I mean, by that I mean DNA, not the size of the exhibition, which is enormous. What have we got here?
Okay, so we're taking people through DNA sequencing from the beginning in the 1970s right through to today and looking at the ethics of what it means in the future. So in front of us here, we've got a sequencing machine, so an iPad game where you're trying to keep up with a machine that would have been sequencing the human genome during the Human Genome Project in the 90s.
So this is not quite hand sequencing. There's earlier in the exhibit, there's a thing where you can sequence by hand, and that it says that it would take 1,000 years to sequence a human genome in that respect. I mean, I'm assuming it's faster now.
Yeah, so where we are now is looking at the speed in sort of mid to late 90s at the height of the Human Genome Project. But even that is way out of date to what we can do today. So today we can sequence a human genome in about a day. The first human genome took 13 years to sequence. So we've come a long way in 10, 15 years.
Let's move around the corner. So this is one of the robots, is it?
So this is one of the DNA sequence machines that we had at the Sanger Institute during the Human Genome Project. So we had about 150 of these during the Human Genome Project. One of the machines that we use today can do more than all 150 of those machines could do at the end of the 90s.
Wow. It's not very big either. It's sort of the size of a large fridge, basically. But this is the cutting edge of genetic research.
It was the cutting edge in the 90s.
Okay,
so we'll
fine.
Take you round.
Not
to,
even the cutting edge.
They're even smaller now. So
let's
we'll take
look.
You round the other side of the exhibit and you can have a look.
So we've come to the cutting edge. Now, what we've got here essentially is what looks like a 1980s desktop computer. So by that, I mean, you know, it's fairly chunky, but it can fit on a desktop quite easily. You could get two or three of those on an average office desk.
Yeah, so these are the sort of machines that are making it into hospitals now. So recently we were involved in a study where we were sequencing the genomes of MRSA, so antibiotic-resistant bacteria, in hospitals, and using it to track an infection as it came out in a hospital.
How quickly can they do that then? How quickly did you get results?
So we can turn around an MRSA genome, which obviously is a lot smaller than a human genome, in just 16 hours.
Wow. So you can see where it's evolving around the hospital, where the sources are.
Exactly. And the great thing is it's quicker than the conventional method of growing up the bacteria on a plate and screening them to see what antibiotics they're resistant to. With DNA sequencing, we can turn it around in 16 hours, know whether they've got the genes that mean they're resistant to the antibiotics, and therefore try and snuff that outbreak out far quicker without the need for, you know, closure of wards or anything like that.
And how much quicker and faster is it going to get? Because we're looking at something that's minuscule compared to the other side of your exhibit, where things are being basically done by hand.
Okay, so we're now looking at about a day for sequencing a human genome. The cost is somewhere between £4,000 to £6,000. And actually, it's the cost that's the key thing here. You know, a CT scan costs about the same. So this is something that is going to move into the hospitals in the next few years, whether it be for helping with outbreaks of MRSA or whether it be for looking at mutations in cancer. It's just going to get cheaper and cheaper. It's just going to get faster and faster. That's technology. That's how it evolves.
Have you had any really good questions here at the exhibit? Interesting ones?
Well, we're asking a lot of questions of the people that come here. You know, we want to know what they think about the ethics of the research that we're doing. You know, do they want to know about the information that's in their DNA? And obviously that's encouraging discussion, which is getting lots of interesting questions for us about the ethics of it, what we think about whether we would like to have our genome sequenced as well as whether they would. But you always get lots of interesting questions at this event, whether they be from kids or be from adults. You know, we've had everyone from 6 to 60 come through the doors. So
you're a geneticist, but you must have wandered around the exhibit a bit. There's some dark matter over there. There's some 3D printers about. Well, what have you liked?
To be honest, I've not had a chance to look around yet. I've seen the zebrafish exhibit, which is really interesting.
Classic science. They just don't move outside their own fields. Steve, thank you very much. It's been fascinating.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Let's move up a scale now, from DNA to bacteria. It's not all full-time academics and scientists at the Royal Society Summer Exhibition. Martin Polyakov pointed out earlier that Borough Bridge High School were here doing fascinating research into the antibacterial properties of essential oils, and I dropped by their stand to find out a bit more.
My name is Colin Ingalls and I'm the teacher at the secondary school that did this research project, and what we've been doing is we've been investigating the antimicrobial properties of essential oils. There's obviously the problem at the moment of antibiotic resistance developing, which is in the papers and a big concern for a lot of the medical institutions. And so with our partner, Professor Kerr from Harrogate Hospital, we've been looking at the quantities of the essential oils that are needed to have an effect on bacterial growth.
So you mean essential oils like the ones we use for massages?
Yes.
Can they actually kill bacteria?
Yes. And that was the initial premise for it. It was, first of all, if you were to have a massage with these oils, is it going to encourage bacterial growth? Because it's a plant-based thing it could do. And so the initial investigation said it doesn't. And then what we've done is we've gone on to look at the concentration at which the oil actually stops bacteria from growing. So here I've got a microtiter tray. Each of the lines of dots is a well into which we put some bacteria. And then we added a different concentration of the oils. So this top row is a 4%, 2, 1, quarter, and 1/8 of a milliliter concentration. This is 1/16 and 1/32. And the bottom two wells, you can see, have gone red. Because
so the 1/16 and 1/32 have gone red, and that means
that the bacteria are growing.
Right. No effect at all.
No effect. So at 1/8 of a percent concentration, the bacteria have been stopped from growing. And this is E. coli, the bacteria, so a gut bacteria. And so we can sort of show fairly reliably that concentration stops them from growing.
And so do we know, I mean, this is the accepted thing that essential oils are antiseptic, essentially.
It's accepted as folklore, but it hasn't been clinically trialled. With the concerns about antibiotics, the people are now beginning to look at the potential for medicinal benefits of using common plant oils for treatments.
Okay. Now, can I ask you another question, which might sound a bit personal? Why are you holding a jar of urine?
I'm really pleased you asked. When penicillin first was discovered and used, it was such a rare and valuable commodity that if you as a patient was given penicillin for a treatment, they would collect your urine, they would extract the penicillin from it so they could give it back to you again, so they didn't lose it. So now today, when people take antibiotics and they don't need them, or if they do need them, when they go to the toilet, their antibiotics are passed out into the waste system and then into the bacteria in the environment.
So you're suggesting we should collect our urine and save the antibiotics?
We could, but the problem is there's so many antibiotics passed out that that's part of the problem. So actually we need to use less antibiotics because you are passing them out and only use them when you really do need them.
I mean, you could have said that on a slide. Why do you still need a bottle of urine in your hand? I don't know.
Because this really gets people's attention. They go, why do you have that?
And also I can smell it from here as well, even though it's in a sealed jar. I don't know if it's just my mind playing tricks on me. you're a teacher. Your students getting involved in this research. This is like primary research. I mean, I didn't know school kids did this sort of thing.
This is a lunchtime microbiology club, so it's not one of their formal lessons. They just come along in the lunchtime, and we've been growing this. We started in October, and we obviously started with a professor coming out to explain the problems of antimicrobial resistance. and that's got them interested. They've learned aseptic techniques and how to culture and grow their bacteria, and then it's all built on from there.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to seeing the research paper whenever that's published.
We'll get onto that one next when we finish here, I think.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
One of the sexiest and most cutting-edge presentations this year is by the University of Nottingham and their Department of Pharmacy. They're combining 3D printing and materials science with stem cell technology. Their exhibition gives us a tantalising hint at the future of medical science, the rebuilding of damaged human organs.
So I'm Kevin Shakeshef. I'm a professor of tissue engineering at the University of Nottingham. And we're interested in taking your stem cells and growing tissues that could be used in the future for medical applications.
Now that sounds fantastic, but I don't see any test tubes or anything around here. What we've got instead is a machine that seems to be printing in 3D. How are you related to that?
That's right. So it's probably best to describe a clinical application that we would use it for. If you lost a lot of bone in your jaw, we would be able to take a 3D image of that and send that image to a machine that would print a perfect template that would be the exact shape of that defect. And so the technology that you see here is printing a three-dimensional polymer, which is a perfect template for new bone to form. So in our patient, it would take about half an hour to print this template. We could then surgically implant it, and we pack it full of stem cells, which allow new bone tissue to form very quickly.
Now, what's disturbing about this is that you just handed me a very small, perfectly formed skull, which you must have printed earlier. How long did this take? It's like this, I can fit this in the palm of my hand. It's very, very small indeed. But it's incredibly detailed. I mean, how long did that take to print?
That one takes about half an hour. Yeah. But actually, the technology would allow us to print that in about 5 minutes if we had multiple scan heads. And so we're thinking that in the operating theatre, the surgeon could have this there, hit print, and 5 minutes later, they've got something that's ready to go into their patient.
So this isn't something that's sort of in science fiction movies. This is something you can put into hospitals right now.
Absolutely,
is it being used already?
It's being trialled, and sort of late animal trials have all been completed. And worldwide, there's a big effort now to get this into the clinic, starting with bone, because that's an obvious first target. But I think in the future you'll see most of the tissues of the body will become printable in our lifetime.
So how big can it get? Could you print a thigh bone or something if necessary?
Yeah, I mean, the technology allows you to make any scale. This particular printer, because it's for show, is quite small. But actually the working parts can be scaled up, so you could make something much larger.
And is it actually expensive?
It's not. It's actually very inexpensive to demonstrate it. This particular machine costs about £3,000. But actually, you can see the components. There's nothing particularly complex there. And as it goes out to the mass market, it will get cheaper. Turning it into something we could use in an operating theatre would add more cost again. But actually, there's no huge barriers to actually translating this.
And what's the white stuff that it's printing with? I can see that essentially the printer is in a sort of... It's in a frame, mm-hmm. and there's a head that moves around in three dimensions.
Yeah.
But it's being fed by a sort of reel of what looks like white wire. What
yeah,
is that stuff?
Right, yeah. It's a polymer, plastic material, which has been used for about 30 years in the human body. So it's a material called polylactic acid. Your body breaks it down into lactic acid, which is a normal food metabolite. And fortunately, this stuff is really good at getting new bone to form. So it acts as a template, and stem cells can lay down new bone structure.
Fantastic. And the thing is, of course, if that was in a lab, people would print pictures of their faces and just for fun, wouldn't they?
Yes.
Have you done that already?
We've done a lot of that.
I bet you have as well. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks very much. That's great. Yeah. Thank you.
From science that works on bodies that are broken, let's now move to some science and engineering that's working with bodies at peak perfection. Olympic athletes. We're at the sports engineering stand here at the Royal Society now, and I've heard that there's a very, very famous bike somewhere around here. Let's have a look. I think it's behind that crowd over there.
My name's Howard Hurst. I'm a senior physiology lecturer at the University of Central Lancashire, and my main area of research is into performance cycling, particularly mountain biking, but I also do some work with track cyclists as well.
Now, talking of cycling, we're standing next to an Olympic gold medal winning bike here. Now, before I do anything with it, I'm going to try and pick this up. I've been told it's very light.
Yes.
And Yeah, it's all right. It's all right. It doesn't have that much. I can lift it with one hand, and I'm not a strong person. Why is this bike so special?
That is Chris Hoy's bike that he rode to gold medal in the 2012 Olympics, and it's been designed to be as minimal as possible. It's cut through air resistance, so we can see we've got a tri-spoke wheel on the front with a solid disc wheel on the back, so that'll cut down on the amount of air resistance. The handlebars, particularly, are very profiled. If you look at a normal set of handlebars, they're very straight, but these are wing-shaped. So again, that'll help reduce aerodynamic drag.
And they look like they're made of carbon fibre too.
Yeah, the whole bike is carbon fibre. All the metal parts are titanium because that's stronger, more durable. The bearings, unlike in your standard bike that you could buy in the shop, are ceramic as opposed to steel because they can tolerate better heat buildup and reduce friction.
And how much is that bike?
To purchase or weight?
Well, in terms of... Well, give me both.
Well, weight-wise, that weighs 14.9 pounds.
Compared to a normal bike?
A normal road bike would weigh around 18 pounds.
Okay. And for those 4 pounds, make all the difference.
It makes a huge amount of difference. The more you can reduce the weight, then the less energy you have to expend to propel that weight.
And if I wanted to buy this bike somewhere or have one made for me...
If you wanted to have that made, it would cost you about £15,000.
Oh, my God. You could buy a car for that.
I just bought a car for that.
And you could go faster than... Parche, Chris Hoy, you're amazing at climbing. But I mean, how much better are these bikes going to get?
Ah, well, that's down to technology. I mean, at the minute, one of my areas of research, we've done a lot of research on power output over the last couple of years, but we haven't really looked at upper body contribution. So at the minute, I'm wearing a series of sensors that looks at the electrical activity of the upper body. So using that, we can feed that back into the design of these bikes. And again, the bars as they are at the minute look very profiled, but we may be able to better design those bikes so the stress is reduced, the strength is increased. And again, that will allow better transfer of power through the pedals and ultimately to drive the bike.
We're talking fractions of a second here, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah. Races are won and lost on thousands of a second these days. So everything we can do to reduce that, then the better. The wheels, I mean, the French recently said that the British cycling team had rounder wheels, which is amusing because of the French wheels they were using. So that shows the lengths that they'll go to just to try and eke out those split seconds.
Fantastic. Can't wait to see the next version of this bike at the next Olympics. Now, I'm going to take a break from the mayhem of that sports science stand to speak to Natalie Starkey. Natalie is working with us on the science desk for a few weeks. Hello, Natalie.
Hello, hello.
You're a cosmochemist, you call yourself, at the European University. What is a cosmochemist?
Well, I look essentially at the chemistry of comets and asteroids. I'm working out what they're made of, and so looking at sample return missions like the Stardust mission and the Rosetta mission.
Okay, cosmochemist by day. Journalistic colleague by night. What have you been looking at around here? We've sent you around with a recorder. What kind of things have you seen around here?
It's just been so varied. It's a really cool exhibition. I wish I'd been able to come here when I was younger. There's just so much science, and speaking to some of the school kids as well has been fantastic because some of them hadn't heard of dark matter and I was like, wow. And so they were here today with Durham University and they were looking, you know, at some of the dark matter research that's been going on, and they had an amazing 3D video that you could watch, which was about 3 minutes long, but it was very cool. And then I've been looking at some environment stuff. So we've got a load of people who are looking at how to harness energy from the oceans, which is a really cool, interesting area. And then the Virus Worlds exhibit, which was really cool as well. That's the Medical Research Council one. And they've made it a bit like Star Wars. They've got like the Death Star as a virus. And that was really, really fun.
It's really fascinating what you said about the school kids who've never heard of dark matter. I mean, for us, we talk about it kind of all the time, and it's one of those things where, when are they going to get to the solution? Come on, pull your fingers out. But these guys have literally never heard. It must be wonderful seeing someone go, wait a minute, that much of the universe isn't there? What have you been doing all this time? I must solve this problem. I must solve this problem. But that's how you get into science, I suppose, as a kid.
I think it's true. I think, you know, they're doing their very kind of what they would consider boring science at school. And actually, they've come here, they've put it into practice and actually see what real scientists are doing on a daily basis and how they might be able to apply what they're learning to what is happening in the real world.
Now, I heard that you met one of our former BA Media fellows and a podcast regular, Geraint Jones. What's he up to here?
Okay, so I was over at the Ice Worlds exhibit, which is a big joint venture between quite a few universities, and they're just looking at all the icy planets and little solar system bodies that we have out there, from, you know, the moons around some of the planets that are nearer to us, all the way out to the Kuiper Belt, which is, you know, unimaginable distances away. And they're looking at kind of imaging these environments and trying to understand whether they're made of methane or water, and really kind of looking at them in detail, either sending spacecraft or looking at them remotely. So they've got a little model of, actually it's not very little, it's quite a big model of Enceladus, and they can press this button and it's got these like water vapor jets that come out of it, so they can show what they've actually observed with spacecraft, and they've got it as a little display here, which is brilliant. Okay, so I've now entered into the Ice Worlds exhibit, which is a joint venture between lots of universities, UCL, Imperial, College London, Queen's University of Belfast and University of Kent. And I've got with me Garant from UCL and also Pedro from Queen's University of Belfast. And actually, we're first going to speak to you, Garant, because we've heard this week that actually Pluto has some moons, which we didn't know before this week.
Yeah, that's right. They were found a couple of years ago, and until this week they were only called P4 and P5. So the first moon of Pluto was found in the 1970s, Charon, and a few years ago a few more were added, and then there were two left that were found very recently, but they weren't named. So finally this week they've been named Styx and Kerberos.
Excellent. So what are these moons made of? Are they rocky? Are they icy?
Mostly icy, with things like methane on their surfaces. Our exhibit is talking about all the icy worlds of the outer solar system, so bodies like Pluto, and other bodies in the Kuiper Belt, which are really far out, and closer in, the moons of the giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, which are really fascinating. A lot of them are really active, with ice volcanoes. Some have got atmospheres like Titan, really complex atmosphere, and amazing geology occurring on lots of them.
And how do we actually find out about these alien environments then? Do we have to send spacecraft out to them?
Ideally, yes. So at the moment, the Cassini-Huygens mission is continuing, so that's orbiting Saturn, passing by lots of these moons, taking images and other data as they go past. So we learn more and more about the moons as the mission goes on. A mission has just been selected to go to the Jupiter system. So JUICE, a European Space Agency mission, will get to Ganymede, ultimately, moon of Jupiter in 2032. And there's a mission on its way now to Pluto, which will arrive in 2015, and that's called New Horizons.
Wow, okay, so there's lots going on in the space world. But we're going to speak to Pedro now, who actually looks at things even further away than Pluto, or maybe as far as Pluto, and to the what is known as the Kuiper Belt. Can you explain to us what the Kuiper Belt is?
Yes, the Kuiper Belt is a sort of a carousel of objects going around the Sun, just like the asteroids go around the Sun between Mars and Jupiter. But these are very far out; they're beyond Neptune, so they're essentially icy. They're all made of ice, and they're all going around the Sun. We started with Pluto in 1930; it was the first discovered. Then in 1992, they found a second, and since then we've discovered more than 1,000 of these things. And what they are is they're leftovers from the formation of the planets. They're pieces that weren't used, and they didn't grow big enough to become a planet. So we study them because you're looking at an earlier stage of planet formation. It's like baby planets or fossils of planets. And by studying them, we're trying to learn how planets form.
Brilliant. So they're holding information right from the beginning of the solar system then, which can be very useful to us. And so what have we found out about them? How many are there? Do we know that?
Yes, we're actually at that level of knowledge. We're trying to find out how many there are. That depends on size. There's a size distribution. If you're talking about the big ones like Pluto, Pluto's size, there's two of them. Pluto and Eris are really big. Then just below that size, there's one called Makemake, is the third largest. And then the fourth largest is a very strange object called Haumea. But then if you go smaller and smaller, there's more and more. And we can only see things maybe down to 50 kilometers across there. And we estimate there's about 50,000 that size.
Wow, okay, so there's quite a lot of them then. So you've got a little model in your hand here. Now, I was just explaining that the exhibit here is really cool. They've got nice little 3D projections of things, and they've got, what's the big model in the corner that has like jets of water vapor coming off it?
That's a moon of Saturn called Enceladus. It's basically an ice ball. It even has the density of ice, and it's covered in ice, very beautiful white with little blue stripes on it. And it has these faults on the surface where jets of water are coming out from the interior, because the the surface is very cool, but in the interior it's warmer. Water there may be slushy snow, maybe even be liquid water, and so there's this jets of vapour coming out.
And I should just say that they've actually got this in action in this room, which is quite cool, although it's a bit warm in here anyway, so maybe we need some nice cold jets of air on us. Yeah. But you've got this other little model in your hand. Can you explain to us what this is?
Yeah, that's Haumea, the fourth largest Kuiper Belt object. It's slightly smaller than Pluto, but the special thing about this one that immediately made it very interesting is that it spins extremely fast. The Earth spins once every 24 hours. This thing spins once every 3.9 hours, so it's six times faster. And because it's spinning so fast, its shape, it would be a sphere if it didn't spin, but it's not. It's stretched. Imagine that the equator is stretched out, so it looks a bit like a pebble. If you see it from the side, it looks like a rugby ball, but if you see it from above, it's actually roundish. So it's basically stretched due to its rotation. And we know that because we only see it through telescopes, so we don't have the luxury of the missions that go to these moons of the giant planets. These things are very far, so we only see them through the telescope, and it's a little blip of light. But we can measure the brightness of that as a function of time, and it varies. And it varies because this object is rotating, so it's showing us different aspects of its shape. And then using that information, we know how fast it's spinning, as I said, 3.9 hours. But we can also calculate what it's made of in the inside, what the density is. And this one turns out to have a density of rock, 2.5 times water. But it's covered in water, so we know it's got a layer of ice on top of a rocky core. So we're just learning these sorts of things, very basic information, how fast they spin, how many there are, what color they are.
So we're learning, actually, that some of these Kuiper Belt comet-like objects are a bit more like asteroids, maybe. They've got rock in them and ice.
This is actually unusual, this one, in being quite dense. It's actually unusual. Other objects that we've measured densities have surprisingly low densities. Smaller objects in the Kuiper Belt have densities of 0.6 times water. They would actually float if you put them in water.
Oh, wow.
So, and that means they're made of ice, almost pure, and then they've got actually significant porosity. There's gaps inside. There's little holes inside, which may actually trap some gases. So that's, indeed, those objects, when they approach the sun, some of them are perturbed by Neptune, which sends them in to the sun. And as they're coming in, the heat from the sun heats their surfaces, and the ices turn into gas and sublimate and make the beautiful tails that we see in comets. So comets come from this region.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, thank you so much, you guys, for speaking to me today. It's been really interesting. Cheers. Thank you.
Well, we can't get much bigger than the entire universe. But Natalie, have you enjoyed your first experience of the exhibition and also the Royal Society? This is the spiritual home of all science.
It's amazing. I haven't been here before. The building is absolutely beautiful, and it's a really good location to have this event.
People tell you that scientists don't have money. This building is dripping in marble and gold.
But no, it's perfect because they've got really big rooms to have all these exhibits in, and plenty of space for everyone to just wander around and bump into people, see what they can learn.
All right, well, I'm sure we've all learnt loads. If you want to come to the exhibition, actually, it's too late because it happened last week. But all the people that we've been interviewing, we'll put links on the blog. So if you want to know more about it, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. Meanwhile, all that remains to be said is thank you very much to Natalie Starkey.
Thank you.
Natalie, goodbye. But from me, Alok Jha, and producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.